Okay, folks, Elvin Shamroth here again. Welcome. I'm going to get right on with it. We always have new sign-ons every time we have a new teleseminar. So for those who have not participated before, the way it works is typically, although this year is unusual, typically we get people who have questions regarding the exam. Typically, it's a question regarding a case on their case list. Maybe they had a complication. Maybe they had an issue which they're not sure how to defend, or perhaps how to present it on paper. And that we ask that those candidates submit those questions to us, or at least not only the questions but the actual case. We have them presented and we discuss it at the teleseminar. People are always kept anonymous. I never mention a candidate's last name, only first names. So you don't have to feel embarrassed in case I ask you a question which you don't know the answer to. You will always remain anonymous. And so we always encourage you folks to volunteer to be on the hot seat. It's a great opportunity to have concerns that you may have regarding a case on your list taken care of. People always come back after and say it was a very good experience, and it's free, folks. I really want to encourage you to make the most of this. I'm making a little bit of a big deal out of it now because 2 weeks ago I was on the verge of saying that we had gone 2 weeks without a volunteer, which is really unheard of, and it makes it a lot less beneficial if no one volunteers. And so I said, I was going to say, we're going to take a break, not every 2 weeks, but the next one will be every 3 weeks if we don't get candidates. And half an hour before the teleseminar, just so happened someone volunteered. But we didn't have that good fortune this time, and so there's no volunteers this time. And I'll talk more about this next, at the end of the course, how we're going to deal with this. So for the purposes of today, I am going to do what I've done in the past, but I've got to be honest with you, folks. I really don't like doing it because it's not as beneficial to you, and it's a little difficult to conduct this because there may be a lot of background noise, and that's a problem. So what I'm going to do, those of you that have joined us before, you know what I do in this situation. I'm going to unmute everyone. So if there's any background noise, it'll be heard. And if you've got 50, 100 people with a lot of background noise, any minimal amount of background noise, it becomes a problem. So I'm going to ask each of you, please make sure you're in a place where there's no background noise, and then we'll have a reasonable chance of having an effective session. What I'm going to do, as I've done before, I'm going to call for volunteers. I'm going to ask that you just shout out your first name. I'll acknowledge, and then we can have a conversation. So let me just unmute everyone. Okay, here we go. I'm going to unmute, and I'm going to ask, please just call out your first name, and I'll acknowledge, and we'll start chatting. So 3, 2. Okay, who has a question? And by the way, all of you have issues. You may not be aware of it, but every single one of you have an issue, and you just, most of you are just too scared to raise the issue, but I encourage you not to be that scared. So go ahead, people. Who of you have a question? Shout out your first name, please. Deathly silence. Folks, if no one volunteers, this is going to be a particularly short teleconference. So please, you folks have issues on your case list. The trouble is you also have issues that you're not aware of. But at least those that you are aware of, let's talk about them. So again, I ask you, I appeal to you, please, anyone want to shout out their first name and we can start a conversation? Still no takers. All right. So this is going to be a very short teleseminar. I'll give one more opportunity. But before I do, I'm just going to give you a little bit of advice as to what you should be doing now. You know, we're into the last quarter, the last 3 months of cashless collection. And what you really need to do now is, number one, go to your shelf in the office and choose 40 cases for the office caseless. Choose cases that provide a good spread of pathology. Choose cases that will be of interest to the examiner. And most important of all, choose cases that you'll be comfortable to engage in a conversation and that you'll be able to show off your knowledge and understanding and grasp of that clinical scenario. So don't have duplicates if you can. It's a maximum of two cases per category. You can have one case per category. Some categories may have zero cases, but you can only have a maximum of 40. And in the preventative care category, for example, in an attempt to broaden the spectrum of pathology, if you're going to put two cases down in that category, I would recommend you put, let's say, an 18-year-old or a 25-year-old. And the second one would be a postmenopausal woman, a 60-year-old, because the conversation is different for those two patients. You don't want to put basically two cases of candida infection, which you can do, but I would strongly recommend against it, because the second case provides no additional scope and spectrum to your pathology. So keep that in mind. Choose 40 cases. Fortunately, it happens only very rarely. A person will put a case of primary amenorrhea on their case list. And I want to implore you, don't do that. Even reproductive endocrinologists don't really have a great time with that conversation. So how much more so us mere mortal generalists? So by all means, have a case of secondary amenorrhea. That's great. But don't have a case of primary amenorrhea. If you put down primary amenorrhea, you've got to be prepared to face questions like, what's the differential diagnosis of a blind-ending vaginal pouch? Discuss the causes of delayed puberty and discuss normal versus abnormal pubertal development. These are questions that I don't think any of us want to face. So please, for heaven's sake, stay as far away from a discussion like ambiguous genitalia, primary amenorrhea, as you can. So again, to choose 40 cases and put them into your case list. If you find you get another case or two or three that's of particular interest and you get picked this up before June 30, you can always delete one of your cases and add the new case to make your cases that much more interesting. So with respect to the office section, get it done, get it completed and out the way. That's a third of your case list. It's a big deal. So finish that. You can finish it now, and then just you have to worry about OB and GYN. Now, with respect to both OB and GYN, we are 3 months away from the end of case list collection. And I want you folks to aim to be at most 4 weeks behind from the time of managing the patient to having entered the patient in the case, in the database. So if today is April the 6th, you should ideally have every delivery, every surgery, every admission that you've done of significance prior to March the 6th, it should be in your cases. Aim to be no more than 4 weeks behind. But by the end of April, you want to try to be no more than 2, maximum 3 weeks behind. And we do it so that by the time you get to June, you're no more than 1 week behind. So when caseless collection is done June 30th, you're basically up to date or no more than a few days behind. So now's the time to start making sure that you're at that place. I will tell you that a lot of people are very slow in getting their case list done. But there's no reason why you can't accomplish what I'm suggesting. It's not difficult. And the longer you wait, it's just going to be the more pressure you put yourselves under. So I encourage you not to do that. So that's what I wanted to share with you today. And folks, we've only been going 10, 12 minutes. And it's really a very half-hearted killer seminar. So I'm going to throw it open to you folks once again. Please, if any of you have any question, please shout out your name and we can talk about it. Otherwise, it's a pity. It's a crying shame. We're going to have to end the teleseminar. So I'm going to throw it out to anyone. Anyone with a question, please just shout out your first name.
Hi, good evening. This is Connie. Thanks for doing this.
Hi. I didn't get your first name. Sorry, what is it?
My name is Connie.
Connie, thank you so much for volunteering. I really do appreciate it. And although everyone else can't really speak for you, they will appreciate it as well. So listen, there's a little bit of background noise from other candidates. Please, can you please make sure there's no background noise? Connie, can you go ahead and share with us what your concern is?
Yeah, so it's more of a basic question. I was specifically about a case. This is my first teleseminar, so I wasn't prepared for the cases yet.
Connie, it's not coming through well on my end. Can you try talking maybe just a little softer? It's coming through as a loud blur. Can you start again? I'm sorry.
Can you hear me better?
That's better, yes. Go ahead, yes.
Okay, so yeah, my question is a little more general. I think it's in terms of the OB and the office caseless. So, if you have a office OB prenatal patient, would you consider that under something more of an office patient, or would you?
Your question is a very good question. As I understand it, if you've got an office OB patient. Does it go in the office category, or does it go in the OB category? Is that your question?
So, sorry, you kind of cut out a little bit.
Your question, if you've got a patient who you see in the office has an interesting issue, and she's also an OB case, which side do you put her on, OB or office? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So look, it's really very easy. If during the 12 months of collecting cases, if she delivers, then you don't have a choice. You have to count her as an OB case because she delivered. The only time you won't list her on your OB list is if she was totally normal. And the criteria for a normal pregnancy and delivery are listed in the ABOG bulletin. It's, you know, at term, spontaneous rupture of membranes, no induction, no augmentation, normal progress, healthy outcome for mom and baby, etc. So if it's normal, then you don't have to list on the OB side. But similarly, if it's normal, there's nothing of interest on the office side. So it's really dictated, and the same holds true but to a less extent on the GYN side. If you've done surgery on GYN or if you've delivered the patient on OB, they have to be addressed and mentioned on the GYN or OB side respectively because you did the surgery, you did the delivery. If you didn't do any of those, on the GYN side, you may be able to, there may be an interesting question, for example, medical treatment with methotrexate for ectopic pregnancy, if she was not admitted. That would be an example where you could include that in the office section. But on OB, it's really tough. And the short answer to your question is, it's going to be a very unusual case where you'd have it in the office section and not in the OB section. Keep in mind, no patient can appear on your case list twice, not in within one section or within multiple sections. No patient can appear on your case list twice. So, Connie, does that answer your question?
Yeah, save it up a little.
All right. Excellent. Sure. Okay. Any other questions? Anyone else, if you've got a question, shout out your name, and I'll acknowledge and we'll talk. So, anyone? Come on, folks. You can do it. Connie, you're still there.
Yeah.
Do you have any other questions that you might want to pose?
I think the question is, and the one that I had was about patients that have been inpatient. So I work as more of a generalist, so I don't always round on, say, someone that I admitted on the day. Is that something that I could still put on my case list, or?
So what I'm understanding is you're saying you may round on. You know what? You must have a specific case in mind. Can you share with us a concrete example, and then I think I'll be able to answer it more specifically.
Right. So this patient, I think, in overnight on another attendant time, we delivered her, and then she had a, she looked like she went, basically went into septic shock, so I managed that period when she went to the ICU. So I don't know, and then I was not there, but then she was discharged.
Okay, it's a very bad line, Connie, but what I understand is you're saying a patient was delivered by a colleague, and you happen to round on her postpartum. Can you enter that case in your list? Is it in your office list? Is that what you're saying?
No, as I think an OB, I think there's one for.
Connie, I'm sorry, it's a very bad line. Can you do whatever you did the first time when it became so much clearer? Because I really can't hear you. Can you try again?
Yeah. So
yeah, that's better.
So for this one, it was I believe she would go under OB, and it would be, I guess, the postpartum care.
Correct. You know, if she's an inpatient, she can't be in the office section.
Yeah. So I that's the, my question is not that. If the question is, if I didn't deliver her, I just took care of her for the acute postpartum period where she went into septic shock, but then I never rounded on her again on the next following day because she went home.
Okay, but was there anything, what was there in the office aspect of her prenatal care that you want to talk about?
Oh, so, but this was separate from the office one. This is not. This is a different patient.
Oh, so we're talking about a different case now. So you just get rounded on her postpartum. Should you include her?
Yes.
Is that your question? Okay, that's a different question. Okay, so this is actually I'm pleased you asked that. It's a very important issue. Strictly speaking, Connie, is this case your case? Is it a totally legitimate case of yours that needs to be put on your case list?
Well, I don't know, because she does fall under the acute maternal decompensation.
But is it your patient? What I'm getting at is if the person, your colleague who delivered her, if he or she is taking the exam, this patient needs to go on his or her case list. But it doesn't go on your case list because you didn't do the delivery. Okay? Now, with that being said, if you rounded on her, and if there's an interesting topic, and if you feel it's a legitimate discussion to have in the exam, then I would have no problems, and I've been advising this for over 20 years. I've never had a single person come back to me and say there was an issue. If you felt this was a good discussion to have, even though you didn't do the delivery, but you managed to postpartum on whatever complication there might have been, I would have no problem putting that down on paper in your OB section, perhaps in the postpartum complications issue. And you can say, even on paper, delivery by colleague, postpartum complication by candidate, to tell the examiner exactly what happened. You're not trying to hide anything. You're not trying to be dishonest. What you're doing is you're giving ABOG more cases than they're asking. I don't have any problem with you giving them more than they ask for. I don't want you to leave off cases. Give them less than they ask for, because that can get you into hot water potentially. So the case, the situation you're talking about, by all means, you can do it. There's just one proviso that you have to be careful with, folks. If you're struggling to get 20 cases, which is the minimum required, 20 cases that count, if you only have 20 cases on your case list, and this case that Connie just mentioned is one of those 20, this case doesn't really count because you didn't do the delivery. It's not yours. So if they were to look into your case list, they would say on the OB side, well, you've listed 20, but only 19 of them are yours. So you've submitted a case list of 19 cases that's inadmissible, and so you things would go awry. So if you do this, if it's a good case, if it's interesting, if it's a subject you can be comfortable to talk about, I don't mind you doing it, provided you are not relying on this case to count as one of the 20. Okay. Connie, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that makes sense. That was helpful. Thank you.
Okay, good, good, good. All right, folks, I'm going to throw it out to you folks again one more time. Come on. It's such an opportunity. I'm not trying to just toot my horn, but it's a golden opportunity to really get concerns and questions taken care of. So don't be shy. I'm going to throw it open again. Anyone want to shout out their name, and I'll acknowledge.
Hello.
Hi there. What's your name?
Hi, this is Joan.
Joan. Did you say Joan?
Yes, that's correct.
Joan, thank you so much for shouting out. I appreciate it. Go ahead. What's your concern?
I had a follow-up clarification on what we just discussed with Connie's question.
Yes.
So for antepartum admissions, there's categories, you know, on like for the OB case list where if
yes.
we don't deliver the patient, but we admit them and we care for them in the hospital, we don't list
yes.
information on the delivery, but it still corresponds with one of the obstetric categories. So are you saying that doesn't count as like part of our minimum?
My understanding, and I'm excuse me, I'm really happy to go back and check myself, and I'm pretty sure I'm correct. There's a column there for every case, antepartum issues, antepartum complications. Yes.
Yes. Well. Yes, but
that's what you're talking about. You're talking about a category of antepartum complications.
No, I'm saying like some of the patients on my case list, I am not doing the delivery, but I admitted them.
Okay, so there are both on the GYN side and the OB side, there are patients that you will admit for a non-deliverable admission. For example, third trimester bleeding, premature labor, pyelonephritis in pregnancy, these diagnoses may require an admission which is not associated with delivery on that admission. And if you're talking about a case like that, that if you admitted her, you need to put her down. So that's, you've brought up an exception. If you admitted a patient, there's a record of it under your name. If she wasn't delivered, and the same can hold true on the GYN side. If you admitted a patient, for example, PID TOA, who, or methotrexate is another example for ectopic, who never went to the OR, that's a non-surgical admission. And likewise, if you admitted that patient, you should put her on. So, Joan, does that answer your question?
Okay. Yes, and then I had another separate unrelated one.
Sure.
I was wondering if you had any advice regarding defending a case list with what may appear to be a disproportionate amount of repeat C-sections due to the fact that the practice that I'm working under does not allow TOLAC.
Okay, so first of all, this is such an important question. I'm so pleased you asked it. And it's important for every single person listening in, because even if you have a low C-section rate, this can come up. And it's actually a favorite question, okay? So if the question, Joan, that you're concerned about is that they will turn around to you and say, well, first of all, what is your C-section rate, Joan? About?
I haven't counted it up.
Just approximately. What would you guess it is?
Looking at all the cases that I have so far, it's probably like between 30% and 50% because of...
Okay, so you're panicking, and just by the way, a lot of people listening in are saying to themselves, I'm so pleased Joan asked that question because I want to know, I've got the same issue. This is not uncommon. You're worried, what am I going to say when the examiner says to me, Dr. Joan, I noticed you've got a C-section rate approximating 50%. How can it be so high? I'm going to give you the specific, the template answer, and I'll mention a few things afterwards. I would answer the following way. Tell me if you like it. I would say, you know, my rate of 45% is high. In fact, I think it's too high, and I'm doing my utmost to bring it down. But there are extenuating factors in my practice. Number one, where I'm practicing, it's hospital policy, or we don't have enough anesthesia, whatever the case may be. I'm unable to offer my patients a trial of labor. And this is tragic because it's a much preferred way to go. Less morbidity, it's just better all the way around. And so I don't have the option. And so my recurrent C-section rate accounts for the bulk of the high rate of my C-section rate. There are also other issues that have come into play. I've noticed there's a, and you can say these things, by the way. I've noticed in the community there's a resistance to having vaginal deliveries. The number of patients coming to me asking for a primary elective C-section has astounded me. I understand that there was on a talk show or a podcast or some TV show, you know, like the Oprah Winfrey or some kind of show, they had an issue on primary elective C-section. And it seems to be socially within the community a done thing that people want an elective primary C-section. And as much as I'm trying to counsel them out of it, I'm coming up with a lot of resistance. I'm hoping over time my message will penetrate. But at least now for this year of collecting cases, that also accounted for a fair number of primary electives. I then looked at my numbers also, and again, you'll notice I had this year 3 cases of placenta previa. That was just unfortunate. I had some abruptions that the fetal heart rate tracing did not allow for a vaginal delivery. I had some patients who had severe hypertension, preeclampsia, severe, remote from term, that I had to get delivered, and C-section was really the only way to go. My principle is I will always try and do a vaginal delivery. I will try and reduce the number of inductions, because if I get a failed induction, that's also a C-section. I always try and take the conservative approach. But this was just a bad year for collecting cases. My C-section rate was about 5-10% higher than it usually is. So, Joan, you heard me say that. How does it sound to you? I mean, I made up a lot of it. Some of it may apply to you, but I'm just giving you an example of how to address that. How does it sound to you?
That makes sense. Thank you.
And at the point I want to make, folks, when I spoke about all these issues, if they are true in your practice, I mean, I gave the example of Oprah Winfrey. In some communities, that could be real. In other scenarios, people don't have in-house anesthesia. It's what you're dealing with, it's okay to mention it, and you should mention it. The one thing, at the end of the day, you've got to leave the examiner with no doubt in your mind that as much as you do it when indicated, and as much as your C-section rate is higher and higher than you would like it to be, from a philosophical point of view, you will always, where possible, try and do a vaginal delivery as opposed to a C-section. You want to be seen to be promoting conservatism. Okay? Joan, does that all make sense to you?
Yes. I think I wanted to confirm that, like, if someone was getting a repeat C-section, but they were a candidate medically for a TOLAC, then in the category, like, under delivery or antepartum, one of those, you're supposed to put declines TOLAC.
Yes.
In a way they are, because we counsel them, like, our practice can't accommodate if they want.
Well,
I
know what you're saying. You can't do TOLAC, but you can offer to transfer them to another hospital, correct?
Right, or another practice at the same hospital.
Or another practice. So then you can write declined TOLAC. I would even be more cryptic, because it sounds like to me that you, Joan, as well as most of everyone listening in, would be very comfortable to have a TOLAC conversation in the exam. So I would word it as saying TOLAC not feasible, because when the examiner reads that, TOLAC not feasible, they're pretty much they're so curious. Why is it not feasible? It's always an option. Why is it not feasible? So you're almost guaranteed that they would ask you, well, why is it not feasible? And once they ask you that question, then they've pressed the go button, the start button on you, and you just start, pouring out all the information you can give them. Okay, does that make sense to you?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, excellent, good. That's folks, for all of you listening, this point is really important, and I'll tell you something else. It is so important that at our definitive board prep course, which I've mentioned to you before, we know historically 99% of you folks listening in are going to come to that course. We will address this very issue at the course. And we'll probably, I'm guessing, spend about 20, 25 minutes discussing this one issue. It's important to everyone taking the exam. So I'm pleased Joan brought it up, but it's relevant to everyone listening in. So, Joan, thank you so much on that. Folks, we've got time for one more. If there's one more person who wants to shout out their name, we can take one more question. Anyone? I'm throwing it open to all of you.
Eleanor?
No one? Yes, I missed the name. Go ahead. What's the name?
Hi, Eleanor.
Hello? Eleanor, hi there. Thank you so much. Yes, Eleanor, go ahead and share with us your question.
Hi, similar to Joan, I am at a small rural facility where we end up transferring a lot of our high-risk patients.
Yes.
So oftentimes if I admit somebody, I'll transfer them, and then I don't really know what their outcome was. And I'm just curious, like, how would you recommend putting that on a case list?
Okay. It's a good question. You be totally honest. You write down on the case what you did, what the diagnosis, what the workup was. And in the treatment column, you write, transfer tertiary care center. Now, that's what you put on paper. How do you prepare for the questions that might arise? Okay? So the examiner might turn around and say, I see you transferred this patient with the mitral stenosis in pregnancy. I'm just pulling that out of thin air. I see you transferred this patient. They may ask you what happened subsequently. And if you know, tell them what you know. The concern of yours probably and most everyone listening in is, what happens if I don't know? How do I handle that situation? It's very simple. You say, I tried to follow up with this patient, but was not successful. So I don't know what happened specifically with this patient. But you don't stop there. Because the examiner wants to have a conversation with you. They don't want to know necessarily what happened to this patient. They want to know, how would you manage a patient with mitral stenosis in pregnancy? So what you say verbally in the exam, if confronted with that question, you say, this patient was actually transferred at 33 weeks or whatever, to a tertiary care center, and unfortunately I was not able to get any follow-up on her. However, this is you continuing, just preempting the examiner. However, if I were to have been the one managing this patient, I would have done 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And you then go on to explain how you would manage this patient and engage in a conversation. So in essence, what you're doing is you're converting it from a specific case to a general case. And then you can go ahead and have the conversation. Again, I repeat, the examiner is not concerned so much what happened to this particular patient. He or she just wants to know, how do you deal with this clinical situation in general? So does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. And I have one kind of specific question about a specific patient. So I have a patient who I saw who had in the office who had an abnormal NIPT and was subsequently diagnosed with trisomy 21 and then was transferred because we don't have MFM services or anything we don't have a NICU or anything. But could that go on my obstetric case list, or would that have to go in the office list because I only saw her in the office?
I'm just trying to recall. I don't know offhand. Help me out here. In the office, there is a category called genetic anomalies, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Yes. So that's definitely an option.
Okay.
The other question is, I mean, this is what you should really be thinking about. The discussion on a case like this is a discussion on aneuploidy screening, correct? That's really
right.
where the conversation
right.
will go. So
right.
ask yourself, is a conversation on aneuploidy screening, is it more likely to occur in an OB-SEP part of your exam or in the office part of the exam?
Yeah.
What would you say?
Probably OB.
I would actually disagree with you. I would say office. These are not admitted patients. They're done as outpatients via the antenatal clinic. It's done at, you know, in the early second trimester. I would argue it's office, not OB.
Okay.
So that's how I would put it in the genetics category. You might even choose to put it in the ultrasound category if there were some anomalies picked up on ultrasound.
Okay,
you've
yeah.
You've got the choice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, great.
All right. Very good, very good. Okay, folks, listen, we were able to get some value out of the session today. But, folks, I'm going to be totally honest with you. The next teleseminar is in 3 weeks' time, the 27th of April. Usually it's every 2 weeks, but for reasons that I'm not sure why, it's on the 27th of April. I will tell you, I turned around to my secretary, I said, no one volunteered before the teleseminar today. And so I'm not going to make it in 2 weeks' time. I'm going to make it in 3 weeks' time, not realizing that it already was in 3 weeks' time. The point I'm making is, folks, and we need you to submit questions and volunteer to be on the hot seat. Otherwise, I will make this every 3 weeks and every 4 weeks. And it's just a pity because you folks are losing out. And I think the words that I'm saying are so golden and, you know, you need to bow down as you hear pure words of glory coming out of my mouth. That's not the case. I just want to do the best I can to help you pass this exam. And this is one opportunity where I really feel, and we've had fantastic feedback over the years, I really feel I can make a difference and really can be beneficial to you folks. So regardless, it was going to be in 3 weeks' time in any case. But folks, please, we need to get you folks to volunteer before the teleseminar actually occurs. And please just get in touch with the office. Either send an email to info@examprof.com, or if you're not sure what the email is, just phone the office. They'll tell you how to do this. But get in touch with the office and submit your question, because otherwise we will continue to do this at 3 weekly intervals, and that would be a pity. It really would be. So to all those people who ultimately volunteered, I really appreciate it. For all of you listening, please, please, volunteer before the teleseminar. Submit your question. It makes it a lot easier and much more meaningful to everyone listening in. So that's it, folks. The next time we'll do this is Sunday the 27th, 3 weeks from now. Finish off your office section. It really is important. All right. Thank you so much, and we'll see you in 3 weeks. Take care. Bye-bye.